Chapter 46. Here the Blessed One was born. The first thing we did after leaving Kusinara was to get lost. In fact, though we did not really have far to go, our journey that day was difficult in a number of ways. Since for the time being we had decided to head due west, we had the sun shining in our faces all the time. Moreover, there was no proper path, and the people of the villages through which we passed always seemed to misdirect us. One man, indeed, refused to direct us at all. When we stopped and asked him the way, he only looked at us with surly suspicion, and inquired, none too politely, who and what we were. We were Buddhist monks, we told him, and were on our way from Kusinara to Lumbini. Oh, he exclaimed, turning away with a hostile sneer, you are the people who have dismembered Dharma, as the Muslims have divided India into Hindustan and Pakistan. He was, of course, a Brahmin. Eventually, after walking for 12 or 13 miles, we reached the village of Ragaganj, on the outskirts of which there was situated the hermitage of an ascetic. Though the place was not much more than a ganja club, the ascetic himself was quite friendly, and not only offered us sugar water, but allowed us to sleep under a tree in the courtyard. In the middle of the night, a storm blew up, and we were forced to retreat into the porch of the hermitage. We did not pass a very restful night. Our main preoccupation next morning was to find a place where we could start putting our begging bowls to the use for which they were intended, and go for alms. Now that we were Shramaneras, we were resolved to do this in strictly traditional fashion. We would beg from door to door until we had obtained enough cooked food for our one meal of the day, not skipping so much as a single house. We would not accept people's invitations, nor would we even sit down inside a house in order to eat the food that we had collected. After walking from 5:30 until 10:30, with only a little chatter to sustain us on the way, we were feeling rather hungry. But at the first township to which we came, we found the atmosphere so forbiddingly commercial that our courage failed us, and tired as we were, we decided not to stop there. Luckily, there was a village only a mile further on. Before reaching the village proper, which was called Basbar, we halted at a well and asked a woman who was drawing water there to pour some into our lotus or brass pots. Respectfully, she refused. She belonged to the Shamar or leatherworker caste, she explained, and for high caste holy men like ourselves, contact with anything that she had touched would mean pollution. Buddha Rakshita and I could hardly believe our ears. The woman at the well was saying exactly the same thing as the Matangi woman had said to Aranda, cousin and personal attendant of the Buddha, 2,500 years ago, and saying it in exactly the same circumstances. History was repeating itself. Making exactly the same reply as Aranda had done, we told the woman that what we wanted was water, not caste, whereupon she gladly filled our lotus. India had not changed much since the days of the Buddha, it seemed. Having quenched our thirst, we made our way to the woman's hut, which was situated nearby, on the outskirts of the village, and stood silently in front of the door with our bowls in our hands. Before very long, a man came out, and after looking at us in a rather puzzled manner, asked us what we wanted. When begging at Orthodox Buddhist doors, of course, a monk never spoke, but here there seemed to be no alternative, and we therefore told the man that we had come for alms. On hearing this, he went inside and quickly returned with a small quantity of paddy or unmilled rice. This we refused, saying that we accepted only cooked things. He thereupon offered us money, but this too we refused. Either there was no cooked food in the hut, or, what was more likely, he was afraid to give it on account of his caste. Not wishing to cause him further embarrassment, we quietly departed. On entering the village, we took our stand at the entrance, to what was probably either a Brahmin or a Kshatriya house, where a number of people had assembled on the veranda. After gazing at us for some time with undisguised astonishment, they asked us what we wanted, to which we again replied that we had come for alms. Like the man in the hut, they at first wanted to give us some paddy, but on being told that we accepted only cooked food, they eventually dropped into our bowls a handful of puffed rice, which, having been parched, was not, in orthodox Hindu eyes, cooked food in the technical sense that boiled rice was. From the buzz of comment that rose from the veranda, it was clear that, astonished as they were by the unfamiliar cut and colour of our robes, and by the fact that we stood holding our bowls in silence, instead of shouting out, "Give alms," as the Hindu ascetics and holy men did, the villagers were still more astonished by our insistence on accepting only cooked food. In their experience, holy men were strict observers of the caste system, and avoided the risk of pollution by accepting as alms only uncooked food. Since from our complexion, dress and deportment we were, so far as they could see, high-caste holy men, they were completely mystified by our disregard of the conventional code. For our part, we could now see that by obliging his homeless disciples to beg from door to door without regard to caste, and to accept only cooked food, the Buddha had initiated a social revolution, a revolution that had been checked in the end by the forces of Brahminical reaction. Our next stop was at a Muslim house. On learning what we wanted, the sarong-clad occupant told us to go round to the back door. If the Hindus saw him giving us alms, he said, he would be in danger of a beating. Who was it that had really divided India, we wondered. Besides giving us alms himself, this friendly son of the Prophet accompanied us to all the other houses we visited, and his explanations saved us a lot of trouble. Indeed, thanks to his exertions, we were able to complete the remainder of our alms round in silence. Some of the people at whose doors we stood were sympathetic, others sarcastic. One well-to-do Brahmin asked us to come in and sit down, saying that, since he had just finished eating and there was nothing left, he would prepare a meal specially for us. This kind offer we refused, as we already had something in our bowls, and our refusal impressed him more than ever. Another Brahmin, who had also just eaten, poured into each of our bowls a pint of milk, in which the puffed rice, boiled rice, curried vegetables, fruits, curds, pickles, and all the other things we had been given were soon afloat. Before long, we had more than enough for our requirements, and we therefore made our way to a mango grove on the outskirts of the village. Since this was the first time we had gone out begging in the traditional Buddhist manner, the occasion was one of unprecedented importance in both our lives, and it was with a sense of elation that we sat down in the deep, cool shade of the handsome trees. Apparently it was something of an event in the life of the village too, for we were followed to the mango grove by a crowd of about 100 people, who, with the dull curiosity of sheep or cows, stood staring at us from among the trees, as though they intended to do so for the rest of the day. Feeling a little uncomfortable under all those eyes, and wishing to be left in peace, we asked them to go away until we had finished our meal. This they eventually did, though not without much urging on the part of our Muslim friend, and many backward glances at us over their shoulders. As soon as they had gone, we put our hands into our bowls, kneaded the contents into a uniform, if rather sticky, mess, and started on our meal. While we were eating, someone came running up with an enormous tray piled high with rice, curries, and lentil soup. Although we already had all that we really wanted, we accepted a small quantity and asked that the rest should be distributed as prasad. According to the scriptures, the first time the future Buddha had tried to eat alms food, he had nearly vomited with disgust. Either we had been brought up less delicately than he had, or we were more fortunate in what we had collected. Far from feeling any disgust, as soon as we had got used to the idea of eating everything mixed up together, we thoroughly enjoyed our meal. What was left over we scattered at the foot of a tree for the birds. When the villagers saw that we had finished, they started drifting back to the mango grove, whereupon, having collected them together and made them sit down on the ground, Buddharakshita addressed them on the necessity of leading a moral life and the importance of observing the five precepts of ethical behaviour. Though this was probably drier spiritual fare than that to which they were accustomed, they listened attentively, and we had the satisfaction of repaying them for their hospitality by preaching the Dharma in the traditional manner. At 3 o'clock, we left for Maharajganj, a village about a dozen miles away. Our second experience of begging our food in the traditional manner was not unlike our first. Having spent the night at Maharajganj, where we slept on a stone platform under a tree, we set out again before 6 o'clock, and after walking all the morning and passing through 4 or 5 villages, some large and some small, we eventually made our way to the village of Teri with the intention of going for alms there. As we entered the place, we saw an aged Vaishnava ascetic with a big rosary round his neck, sitting on a bedstead, making a kamalandu, the special water pot carried by Orthodox Hindu monks. Without pausing in his work, he called out to us rather roughly and asked us what we wanted. When we explained that we had come for alms, he told us, none too politely, that he could not give us anything. The first house outside whose door we stood did not give us anything either, but at all the remaining houses, the womenfolk proved wonderfully kind and generous. On hearing that we were willing to accept cooked food from them, even though they belonged to the Ahir, or dairy farmer caste, a very low caste indeed, they gave us rice, unleavened bread, vegetable curries, lentil soup, and curds in such profusion that both our bowls were quickly filled. Since there was no mango grove at Teri, we had to finish our second meal of alms food in whatever shade was available, after which we walked a short distance along the riverside until we came to a fine shady mango tree, where we rested for a while, and where an old woman brought us drinking water. We then continued our journey, following the river for a few miles until we came to another village. Though late afternoon, it was still scorching hot, and having quenched our thirst at the forestry department pump, we were glad to sit down for a few minutes at the edge of a grove of sal trees. Shortly after this, for the second time since leaving Kusinara, we lost our way. In the absence of any road, we had been forced to try and find our way across the fields, with the result that before long we found ourselves wandering round in circles, unsure in which direction we ought to go. We were still wandering in this manner when we stumbled, quite by accident, upon a small village where an old Shaivite devotee received us with the greatest respect and insisted on giving us sugar water to drink. He and a Muslim neighbour then not only directed us which road to take, but were also good enough to accompany us for a short distance so as to make quite sure that we did not miss it. From then onwards we had no difficulty. After being given more sugar water to drink, this time by a sympathetic shopkeeper, we met up with our old friend the railway line, and after following it eastward for a mile, reached the township of Nautanwa. On our arrival at the Lumbini Rest House, a tiny building not far from the centre of the town, we were at once warmly welcomed by the thin and elderly but extremely active and energetic Sinhalese monk who had been posted there by the Mahabodhi Society to look after the needs of pilgrims on the last stage of their journey to the birthplace of the Buddha. Despite his great seniority in the order, Venerable K. Sirinivas Nayaka Mahatera was no stickler for protocol, and seeing how hot and tired we were, cheerfully set about lighting a fire and preparing tea. "What if we are only shamaneras and he an elder," he declared, brushing aside our protests. We obviously needed a cup of tea, and since the servant had gone home for the night and would not be back until morning, he would prepare it. 2 days later, having passed the time pleasantly enough in the company of our friendly and communicative host, we left Nautanwa for Lumbini. With us were Brahmachari Munindra, a Barara Buddhist whom we had met at Sarnath, and two young friends of his, Arun Chandra, an Indian, and Yu Thong Ong, a Burmese, all of whom had arrived late the previous night, long after Buddharakshita and I had finished talking with Venerable Sirinivas and gone to bed. Since Ang was travelling with a certain amount of luggage, a coolie had to be engaged in the bazaar, a process which occasioned some loss of time and no little trouble. Eventually, we were all ready to start. After walking for nearly 2 miles, we came to the river that marked the boundary between India and Nepal. At this time of year, it was a river bed rather than a river, and we had no difficulty in wading through the sluggish trickle of muddy water that still flowed in the deepest part of the channel. On the other side, a broad dirt track led through the sparse jungle of the Terai, and following this, we traversed 2 villages, at the second of which Munindra and Ong stopped for a drink of milk. On the way, we saw a black antelope and a small herd of red deer browsing among the sal trees. Lumbini was now quite near, the coolie told us. Quickening our pace, we traversed 2 more villages, and before long could see in the distance 2 mounds of earth surrounded by small brick towers with a diminutive temple in between. During the couple of days that we spent at Lumbini, our feelings were divided between joy at being at the very spot where the future Buddha had first seen the light of day, and a sense of regret, even outrage, at the desolate and neglected appearance of the sacred place. It was as though the tide of Buddhist revival, which flowed strongly at Sarnath, and none too feebly at Kusinara, had as yet hardly touched Lumbini. The only modern building to be seen was the rest house erected by the government of Nepal for the benefit of pilgrims, where we installed ourselves soon after our arrival, and where the caretakers provided us with a meal. Those other than pilgrims found it convenient to use the rest house, however, either because there was no other accommodation, or because in this land of autocracy, even the lowest representative of authority was accustomed to behave in a high-handed manner. Touring government officials regularly treated it as a sort of caravanserai. On the evening of our arrival, a police inspector turned up with 20 of his men, and soon the peace and silence of the place were lost in uproar. Next day it was even worse. While their master was busy squeezing money from the local landlords, who from time to time arrived on elephants, bearing with them the customary gifts, some of the inspector's men slaughtered a goat in the compound, and without removing its hair, hide, or anything else, cooked it whole over an open fire. Though Munindra, Arun Chandra, and Thong Ong were by no means vegetarians, on seeing this gruesome sight, all 5 members of our little party felt like making a strong protest. But on reflection, we decided not to do so. The police inspector had been drinking since early morning, and to judge from the way in which he was behaving with the landlords, he was not the sort of person who would be amenable to reason. All the same, we could not help thinking how sad it was that the first precept, the precept of abstaining from injury to any living being, should be so flagrantly violated in the very birthplace of the Buddha. Apart from the 2 mounds, which rose like 2 volcanic islands out of a perfect sea of loose bricks, and seemed to have once formed the lower half of 2 stupas, the only ancient building of which any trace remained above ground was the Ramindai Temple. This was so small as to be a chapel rather than a temple, and in an extremely dilapidated, not to say ruinous, condition. On our first visit to the place, soon after our arrival, we found the door locked, and it was not until the evening of our second day at Lumbini that it was opened by the old Hindu woman who kept the key, and was responsible, so it seemed, for the rudimentary worship that kept alive the religious traditions of the place. The interior of the temple was disappointing. The only object of interest was a stone slab, so well worn and so thickly smeared with vermilion, that the figure of Mahamaya, holding on to the branch of a sal tree as she stood giving birth to the future teacher of gods and men, was barely discernible. On our questioning the old woman, it soon became clear that she had not even heard of the Buddha or of Buddhism, and that she was under the impression that the temple was dedicated to a Hindu goddess. More easy of access was the Ashoka pillar nearby, which stood beneath the open sky behind a low iron railing. On its highly polished surface, the ancient Brahmi letters were cut so deep and clear that we could still spell out the announcement, "Here the Blessed One was born." For some reason or other, I felt even more deeply moved here than I had done either at Sarnath or Kusinara. The truncated stone shaft stood so calmly and so simply beneath the cloudless blue sky. It seemed so unpretentious, and yet to mean so much. Lingering behind, when Buddha Akshita and the others had moved on in the direction of the mounds, I gathered some small white flowers, and with a full heart scattered them over the railing at the foot of the column. As I did so, I heard Buddha Akshita's voice. "What are you messing about with those flowers for?" he shouted roughly. "Come on, we can't wait for you all day." The following morning our party broke up. Munindra and his two young friends returned to Nortanwa with their coolie. Buddha Akshita and I set off through the jungle for Bhutal. With us went three or four local people who were also travelling part of the way, and who were glad, it seemed, to make the journey in the company of two ascetics, probably because of the belief that holy men are never attacked by wild animals. In the course of a few hours we passed through two villages. At the second, the last of our companions left us, and Buddha Akshita and I refreshed ourselves with a quick bath. We then had to pass through a stretch of thick forest, but though we took the wrong turning more than once and had to retrace our steps, we managed to find our way along the narrow jungle tracks, and after passing through two more hamlets, eventually emerged at the prosperous Taru village of Farsatika Bazar. Here we had our third experience of going for alms. At the first house we got nothing. At the second, a buxom young woman sprawling on a string bed just inside the door jeered, "Wearing spectacles, are you? Think you're very high and mighty, don't you?" Then her voice rising in a shriek of fury, "Go on, why don't you go and work for a living?" Out of the corner of my eye, I saw that my friend's face had flushed purple with rage, but controlling himself with an effort, he repeated the customary benediction, and we moved on to the next house. In rural Nepal, as in rural India, it seemed, spectacles were still regarded as a species of jewellery, as were fountain pens and wristwatches, and as such could be fittingly worn only by worldly, semi-westernised young men of some social pretensions. The women of the other houses to which we went were more sympathetic, and our bowls were soon almost full. At the last house of all, indeed, the old woman who came to the door was so amazed at our willingness to accept cooked food from such a low-caste person as herself, that, tremulous with joy, she hurried back into the house and returned with all the rice, lentil soup and curds that we needed. We then sought out a secluded spot at the far end of the village and ate our meal sitting inside a cow pen. All around us were the pleasant signs of rural prosperity. Cows were fatter and sleeker than any we had yet seen. Barns were overflowing with fodder. Under the projecting eaves of the mud-walled houses, rows of enormous earthenware jars, each one higher than a man and of corresponding girth, stood brimming with grain. The people, too, though not yet mongoloid of feature, seemed stronger and healthier than those of India. While we were eating, Buddharachita expatiated on our encounter with the young woman on the string bed. He was overjoyed that she had abused us, he declared. Not for anything in the world would he have missed the experience. Now, and now only, could we consider ourselves monks indeed. We had been found worthy to share in the insults that had rained down not only on the head of the Buddha himself, but on the heads of all his worthy disciples down the ages. Having rested for a while under a tree some distance from the village, we set off once more, and though the jungle became much thicker, succeeded in passing through three or more villages without losing our way too often. Ever since our departure from Lumbini, the type of vegetation had been changing from subtropical to temperate, and by this time the whole countryside was not only far greener, but full of brooks and streams. What with the softness and springiness of the turf, the shafts of sunlight that came slanting down through the big leafy trees, the coolness and the quiet that was broken only by the clear, fluting calls of birds, it seemed as though we were passing through a stretch of English woodland rather than through a region of the Nepal Terai, only a few miles from the foothills of the Himalayas. For a moment I fancied I was a boy again, wandering among the bluebells and bracken in the depths of Wimbledon Common. For the last 2 or 3 miles of our journey, the path ran beside a broad river fringed with reeds and water flags, and as soon as we could find a suitable spot, Buddharachita and I stopped and took a dip in the clear, ice-cold current. Soon afterwards, we saw rising up, like a grey-green wall before us, the first range of foothills. Below the foothills, on the banks of the river higher up, there stretched in ugly perspective, row upon row of corrugated iron roofing, of every conceivable variety of rust, and in every stage of decay. We had reached Bhutan.